Let's take a wider view now and look at the principles that guide the design of a story's progressions. Composition means the ordering and linking of scenes. Like a composer choosing notes and chords, we shape progressions by selecting what to include, exclude, to put before and after what. To guide our efforts, the art has evolved canons of composition: unity and variety, pacing, rhythm and tempo, social and personal progression, and symbolic and ironic ascension. A story, even when expressing chaos, must be unified. We should sense a causal lock between the inciting incident and the story climax. The inciting incident is the story's most profound cause, and therefore the final effect, the story climax, should seem inevitable. The cement that binds them is the spine, the protagonist's deep desire to restore the balance of life. Within this unity, we must induce as much variety as possible. Casablanca, for example, is not only one of the most loved films of all time, it is also the most various. It is a brilliant love story, but more than half of the film is political drama. Its excellent action sequences are counterpointed by urbane comedy, and it's the next thing to a musical. Over a dozen tunes strategically placed throughout comment on or set up event, meaning, emotion. If we try to pace a story by slowly turning the screw, increasing tension a little more, a little more, a little more, scene by scene by scene by scene, we wear the audience out long before the ending. They go limp and have no energy to invest in the story climax. Instead, we use act structure to start at a base of tension, then rise scene by sequence to the climax of Act 1. As we enter Act 2, we compose scenes that reduce this tension, switching to comedy, romance, a counterpointing mood that lowers the Act 1 intensity so that the audience can catch its breath and reach for more energy. We coach the audience to move like a long-distance runner who, rather than loping at a constant pace, speeds, slows, then speeds again, creating cycles that allow him to reach the limit of his reserves. Act by act, we tighten and release tension until the final climax empties out the audience, leaving it emotionally exhausted but fulfilled. Rhythm is the length of scenes. How long are we in the same time and place? A typical two-hour feature plays 40 to 60 scenes. This means, on average, a scene lasts 2.5 minutes. But not every scene. Rather, that for every one-minute scene, there's a four-minute scene. For every 30-second scene, a six-minute scene. In a properly formatted screenplay, a page equals a minute of screen time. Therefore, if as you turn through your script, you discover a two-page scene followed by an eight-page scene, a seven-page scene, three-page scene, four-page, six-page, five-page, one-page, nine-page. In other words, if the average length of scene in your script is 5 pages, your story will have the pace of a postal worker on Valium. Most directors' cameras drink up whatever is visually expressive in one location within 2 or 3 minutes. If a scene goes on longer, shots become redundant. The editor keeps coming back to the same establishing shot, same two-shot, close-up. When shots repeat, expressivity drains away. The film becomes visually dull, and the eye loses interest and wanders from the screen. Do this enough, and you will lose the audience for good. The average scene length of 2 to 3 minutes is a reaction to the nature of cinema and the audience's hunger for a stream of expressive moments. When we study the many exceptions to this principle, they only prove the point. 12 Angry Men takes place over 2 days in a jury room. In essence, it consists of 2 50-minute scenes in one location with a brief break for a night's sleep. But because it's based on a play, director Sidney Lumet broke the jury room into sets within the set. The drinking fountain location, cloakroom, window, one end of the table versus the other. Within these sub-locations, he staged scenes. First, jury members number 1 and 2, then two exits, while 5 and 7 enter. Cut to 6 alone, cut to all 12, cut to 5 of them off in a corner, and so on. The over 80 scenes in 12 Angry Men build an exciting rhythm. My Dinner with Andre is even more contained. A 2-hour film about a 2-hour dinner with two characters, in essence, one huge scene. Yet the film pulses with rhythm because it's paced with scenes created, as in literature, by painting word pictures on the imagination of the listener. Who could forget the scene in the Polish forest, or Andre's friends burying him alive in a bizarre ritual, or the synchronistic phenomenon he encounters in his office? These erudite recountings wrap an education plot around an education plot. As Andre relates his quixotic adventure toward spiritual development, he cants his friend's view of life so that Wally leaves the restaurant a changed man. Tempo is the level of activity within a scene via dialogue, action, or a combination. For example, lovers talking quietly from pillow to pillow may have low tempo, an argument in a courtroom high tempo. A character staring out a window, quietly coming to a vital life decision, may have low tempo. A riot, great tempo. In a well-told story, the progression of scenes and sequences accelerates pace. As we head toward act climaxes, we take advantage of rhythm and tempo to progressively shorten scenes while the activity within them becomes more and more brisk. Like music and dance, story is kinetic. We want to use the cinema's sensory power to hurl the audience toward act climaxes because scenes of major reversal are, in fact, long, slow, and tense. Climactic does not mean short and explosive. It means profound change. Such scenes are not to be skimmed over, so we open them and let them breathe. This tense pause must be earned by the rising pace that builds it. When a story genuinely progresses, it calls upon greater and greater human capacity, demands greater and greater willpower, generates greater and greater change in characters' lives, and places them at greater and greater jeopardy. How are we to express this? How will the audience sense the progressions? There are 4 primary techniques. Number 1, widen the impact of character actions into society. Let your story begin intimately, involving only a few principal characters. But as the telling moves forward, allow their actions to ramify outward into the world around them, touching and changing the lives of more and more people. Kramer versus Kramer. The inciting incident involves only the 3 Kramers. But as action progresses, many lives are changed. Because Kramer services the most important clients at his advertising agency, his boss fears that Kramer's domestic troubles threatens the careers of himself and all his employees, and so he fires Kramer. A divorced single parent living down the hall from the Kramer apartment becomes Billy's surrogate godmother and Ted Kramer's champion in court. The conflict affects Kramer's relationships with women he meets, as well as Mrs. Kramer's new boyfriend and psychiatrist. Teachers, doctors, social workers, and finally lawyers and courts are all pulled into the web of the Kramer custody battle. Number 2, drive actions deeply into the intimate relationships and inner lives of the characters. If the logic of your setting doesn't allow you to go wide, then you must go deep. Start with a personal or inner conflict that demands balancing, yet seems relatively solvable. Then, as the work progresses, hammer the story downwards, emotionally, psychologically, physically, morally, to the dark secrets, the unspoken truths that hide behind a public mask. Ordinary People is confined to the family, a friend, and a doctor. But it goes far deeper than Kramer versus Kramer, whose characters mature to emotional health. From a tension between mother and son that seems solvable with communication and love, it descends to grievous pain. as the father slowly comes to realize he must choose between the sanity of his son and the unity of his family, the story drives the child to the brink of suicide, the mother to a revelation of her hatred for her own child, the husband to smashing the genuine love between him and his wife. 3. Build the symbolic charge of the story's imagery from the particular to the universal, from the specific to the archetypal. Good story, well told, good film. But all that, plus the power of subliminal symbolism to lift the story to the next level of expressivity, perhaps great film. Symbolism is very compelling. Like images in your dreams, it invades the unconscious mind of the audience and touches it deeply, as long as the audience is unaware of its presence. If, in a heavy-handed way, we label images as symbolic, their effect is destroyed. But if they are slipped quietly, gradually, and unassumingly into the telling, they move us profoundly. Start with actions, locations, and roles that represent only themselves. But as the story progresses, choose images that gather greater and greater meaning, until by the end of the telling, characters, settings, and events stand for universal ideas. The Deer Hunter introduces steelworkers in Pennsylvania who like to hunt, drink beer, and carouse. They're as ordinary as the town they live in. But as events progress, settings, roles, and actions become more and more symbolically charged, building from the tiger cages in Vietnam to the highly symbolic scenes in the Saigon casino where men play Russian roulette for money, culminating in a crisis at the top of a mountain. The protagonist, Michael, progresses from factory worker to warrior to the hunter, the man who kills. The film's controlling idea is, we save our own humanity when we stop killing other living beings. If the hunter spills enough blood, sooner or later he runs out of targets and turns the gun on himself. He either literally kills himself, as does Nick, or more likely, he kills himself in the sense that he stops feeling anything and falls dead inside. The crisis of this film sends Michael in his hunter's garb, armed with a weapon, to a mountaintop. There, on a precipice, the prey, a magnificent elk, comes out of the mist. An archetypal image, hunter and prey at the top of a mountain. Why the top of a mountain? Because tops of mountains are places where great things happen. Moses is given the Ten Commandments, not in his kitchen, but at the top of a mountain. 4, turn progressions on irony. Irony is the subtlest manifestation of story pleasure. It sees life in duality. It plays with our paradoxical existence, aware of the bottomless gap between what is and what seems. Verbal irony is found in the discrepancy between words and their meanings, a primary source of jokes. But in story, irony plays between actions and results. Moulin Rouge. The crippled artist Toulouse-Lautrec falls in love with the beautiful Suzanne, but can't bring himself to tell her this. She accompanies him as a friend around Paris. Lautrec becomes convinced that the only reason she spends time with him is that it gives her the opportunity to meet handsome men. In a drunken rage, he accuses her of using him and storms out of her life. Sometime later, he receives a letter from Suzanne. Dear Toulouse, I'd always hoped that someday you might love me, but now I realize that you never will. So I've taken the offer of another man. I don't love him, but he's kind, and as you know, my situation is desperate. Adieu. Lautrec frantically searches for her, but indeed she's left to marry another. So he drinks himself to death. Crisis is the third of the five-part form. The Chinese ideogram for crisis is two terms, danger, opportunity. Danger in that the wrong decision at this moment will lose forever what we want. Opportunity, in that the right choice will achieve our desire. Characters make spontaneous decisions each time they open their mouth to say this, not that. In each scene, they make a decision to take one action rather than another. But the crisis, with a capital C, is the ultimate decision, a moment of dangerous opportunity. The protagonist's quest has carried him through the progressive complications until he's exhausted all actions to achieve his desire, save one. He now finds himself at the end of the line. His next action is his last. No tomorrow, no second chance. This is the moment of greatest tension in the story, as both the protagonist and audience sense that the question, how will this turn out, will be answered out of the next action. The crisis is also the obligatory scene. From the inciting incident on, the audience has been anticipating with growing vividness the scene in which the protagonist will be face to face with the most focused, powerful forces of antagonism in his or her existence. This is the dragon, so to speak, that guards the object of desire, be it the literal dragon of Jaws or the metaphorical dragon of meaninglessness in Tender Mercies. The audience leans into the crisis, filled with expectation mingled with uncertainty. In order to place the protagonist under the maximum pressure of his life, the crisis must be true dilemma, a choice between irreconcilable goods, the lesser of two evils, or the two at once. How he chooses here gives us the most penetrating view of his deep character, the ultimate expression of his humanity. So he draws on the dregs of his willpower, chooses an action he believes will achieve his desire, but, as always, his world won't cooperate. Reality splits and he must improvise. The protagonist may or may not get what he wants, but it won't be the way he expects.